Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. It's all coming down to turnout. This election, like the two before it, will be decided on the margins. Not necessarily by people still deciding between Harris and Trump, but by people deciding whether they're going to vote at all. Which means these final weeks are all about persuasion, persuading your supporters to vote. So how do you do that? About two-thirds of Americans' eligible population turned out in 2020, which means a third of us stayed home. Ohio was a bit better. Only a quarter of us sat out the last presidential election. But still, that's 2 million people, enough to have changed the outcome. Joining us to kick off a conversation about getting out the vote in the final weeks is Jen Perez. She's an Ohio program director for Red, Wine, and Blue, a progressive group organizing women and mothers here in Ohio. Welcome to All Sides, Jen.
Thanks for having me.
For people who've never heard of Red, Wine, and Blue, can you tell us about the organization?
Yeah, absolutely. Red, Wine, and Blue is a powerful grassroots network of over 600,000 suburban women working together to fight extremism. And we provide everything that women need to successfully organize in their own communities and across the country, many of them for the first time. Lots of our members are saying that they would have never considered themselves political a year or two ago. Our organization was founded right here in Ohio, and we really just work to connect and educate women so that they feel empowered to have conversations with their friends and family. And we bring women from all political backgrounds to the table, to these conversations, to build that community together.
Yeah, your website explicitly says, not political, no problem. In fact, it's perfect.
Yes, I love that.
So let's talk about some of the issues that matter to women, because it's not just abortion. Groceries, gas, kitchen table issues are just as important to women surveyed as they are to men.
Absolutely. Yeah, and it is, you know, the economy is very important to women that we are talking to, as well as our reproductive rights. We know that here in Ohio, you know, these issues are what women and their friends are talking about. These are the issues that can make or break whether someone decides to maybe step out of their comfort zone and take some action, whether that's, you know, phone banking or talking to their own friend about what's important to them.
I do want to ask, though, even though there's this critique of women as single issue voters, and sometimes as a woman myself, you know, I'm a suburban mom of two, it feels a little pedantic to say, here are the things I think you care about.
Absolutely. Yes. Women, you know, I think a lot of women might say if they were a single issue voter, that issue is freedom, right? And to not have politicians kind of in our decision-making as mothers, as women, whether that's, you know, how we're going to pay our bills or what kind of medical decisions we're making with our doctors.
How much of a motivator has it been for Democratic women or perhaps independent women that you've observed? How much of a motivator basically has, sorry, I got twisted up there, has J.D. Vance and Bernie Moreno's comments been?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. You know, I think a lot of us saw the video of Bernie Moreno mocking suburban women over 50, calling us out as being single issue voters. And women across this state have said that doesn't represent us. That's not who we are. And I think it's really been empowering. You know, it's been over 2 years since the Dobbs decision happened that rocked a lot of our worlds. And that single Supreme Court decision really motivated a lot of women to step out of their comfort zone. Like you said, on our website, it says not political, no problem. In fact, that's perfect. And last year here in Ohio with our issue one that we passed, we saw women who said they never even sold Girl Scout cookies as a child because they just were that uncomfortable approaching strangers, who said, here I am years and years later collecting signatures for this very important issue. So when we look at the words, that are coming out of some of these candidates' mouths, that's not who we are here in Ohio. Those are not the values that we embrace.
That's the perfect segue to my next question, which is that the 2023 results for the Reproductive Rights Amendment looked, at least to me, like a roadmap for Democrats, the kind of map you might have seen for the party 10 or 20 years ago. There was a close call, you know, it was very close in Butler. They were winning parts of Northeast Ohio that have now gone Trump in the last two elections. Delaware voted like the state. That looks like the map that a Democrat would want were they to be elected.
Absolutely. You know, we that issue last year passed by 57% of the vote. We know that women, men, Ohio voters, whether they're Republican, Democrat, or independent, supported and still do support the right to reproductive freedom. So, you know, when we think about how to lay out a map in Ohio, you know, last year there were counties, 18 of them that voted for Trump in 2016, but then passed issue one here last year. So, you know, we're seeing Ohio change. We are seeing former Republicans being willing to vote for Democrats, especially when we talk about these down ballot races, because they're looking for candidates who embrace their values and are who are going to protect their rights.
We also want to hear from you, our Ohio voters, this hour. If there's a particular issue motivating you to the polls or motivating you to knock on your neighbors, you can give us a call at 614-292-8513, or you can email allsides@wosu.org. I want to ask about the divide between male and female voters because it's increasing, with women increasingly voting Democrat and men, particularly younger men in this election, leaning Republican. What do you make of that growing split in the genders voting for different parties?
That's a great question. I think, you know, one thing that comes to mind when we talk about men and women voting also is that there was a report from Sister District earlier this year that showed that 81% of men vote all the way down ballot versus only 68% of women.
We're the ticket splitters.
Yes. And so, you know, one thing we're really focusing on is when you identify issues that are important to you or your friends and start having conversation with the people in your lives, you can help the women who you're seeing on a regular basis. So I have a fourth grader who plays sports. You know, there are other moms that I see on a regular basis at those games, and we can talk about issues that matter to us, and I can make sure that I'm stressing the importance of voting all the way down ballot and increasing that number so that women are at least meeting the men as far as voting all the way down ballot, especially in Ohio this year. I mean, we have so many important down ballot races.
Yeah. From issue one on redistricting to the state Supreme Court to, I would argue, your state House and state Senate representatives. So.
100%. You know, we talked about last year's issue one, and we fought so hard to
Ooh.
collect all those signatures. Our Ohio Supreme Court is where we really continue the fight and work to protect everything we fought so hard for last year.
Do you think Ohio's voting laws help or hinder voting?
Well, our voting laws, you know, I look at some of our neighboring states like Michigan and some of the laws that they have as far as voting, and they definitely hurt our ability for all Ohio eligible voters to vote. You know, we've got our new voter ID law that came into effect recently, where ID that you used to be able to bring with you to vote on election day, you no longer can. So that's another thing that we are really stressing to make sure everyone understands that you need a valid form of state-issued ID to be able to vote in person. Our registration laws, I would love to see same-day voter registration like some of our neighboring states have. And so, you know, we're at the point for this election where we've passed our voter registration deadline. So at this point, if you're not registered, you will not be able to vote on November 5th or during early voting. But there's definitely some opportunity for us to expand our voting rights laws and make it easier for every eligible voter to be able to vote in the state.
So now the campaign turns to turn out. You can't register anybody else. You've got to convince everybody who has registered, particularly those new and first-time registrations, to vote. I guess that's the million-dollar question. How do you do it?
Yeah, that is the million-dollar question. And you know, there's a lot of money that goes into making that happen. And what we focus on at Red, Wine, and Blue is relational organizing. So friend-to-friend organizing. And we see that, you know, there are lots of people who are out there knocking doors, phone banking, text banking, and that work is so important to get people out to vote. And we're trying to kind of find our spot and fill a gap that says, okay, if you are talking to someone that you know, that you have trust with, you have a relationship with, that is going to be much more effective than a stranger knocking on your friend's door. I actually have some data that says talking to a friend about issues is 37 times more effective than sending a postcard to a stranger. So, you know, we're just really leaning into that friend-to-friend organizing. We're holding events about all the different topics. We are doing an event actually next week on Zoom where we're calling it Make a Date with Your Ballot. And everyone's going to open their sample ballot. We're going to go through it. We're going to talk about what all these different positions are. What is the role of a county commissioner? What do they do? Why is it important to your life? And again, this is to help educate women, not only so that they can make informed decisions when they're voting, but also so they can talk to their friends and family. So, you know, we give them links that they can text out. I know I have a lot of friends who are coming to me with these last 2 weeks before the election who are kind of just now waking up and being like, oh yeah, I got to figure out how I'm going to vote. And I'm sending them like, hey, download your sample ballot, print it out, do your research, mark it up, and take that printout with you. You can take, you know, some paper with you when you go to vote. You can take your phone with you if you make a note on your phone. So just really having those conversations with the people we know, that's how we can all kind of cut through the noise of everything that's going on.
Yeah, my husband does that to me. I'm his phone a friend. He'll be there like, "Hey, what is this? Can you walk me through it?" And I'm like, "All right, here you go."
Yeah. We all need a phone a friend. That's a great way to put it. And that's, you know, that's what we're trying to do is build a group of women who are the phone a friend, where their friends are reaching out to them and saying, hey, Jen, I know you're way more involved in this and you know more than I do. Like, I trust what you are saying. Help me understand. You know, we look at issue one and the confusing language that's on the ballot. Help me understand what it means. And I'm seeing vote yes signs and vote no signs that say the same thing. How do I know which way to vote?
So, what are some practical tips for someone listening who says, "How on earth do I begin this conversation?" Right? We're not supposed to talk about money, religion, politics. How do you broach the topic with a friend?
It's a great question. I think, you know, the way I think about it is we don't want you to like walk up to your friend and say, hey, Anna, I'm here to talk about the election, right? Like,
That's like a door knocker.
exactly. That's not the best way to do it. And you know your friends and your family, and you know what's important to them. So just like any other conversation, what I have found personally is that as I am more knowledgeable about these topics, I can weave it into conversations that we're having. So right now, it's pretty easy because we're 2 weeks out from a presidential election
It comes
where
up.
it comes up. And so someone, you know, especially in Ohio, I'm having a lot of conversations where someone's like, oh, did you see that ad on TV? Right. And that opens the door. And so then I can continue the conversation and say, yeah, like I've seen all the ads, right? And while there's a lot of noise coming through our TV, coming in the mail, coming through our text messages and things like that, here's what is important to me, right? And really use it as an opportunity to find common issue. You know, if I have people I'm talking to, like we have a school tax levy where I live. So that might be something that we are talking about. And then it kind of opens the door to say, oh yeah, the tax levy is going to be at the end of our 4-page ballot this year. Let's talk, like, make sure you know about everything in the middle, right? It's not just about the top and the bottom of the ballot. And this year we've got some long ballots. I know up in some of the northern counties, it's going to be 6 pages long. So there's a lot that we're voting on this year.
Yeah, I live in Delaware, and w they are proposing changes to the city charter, including moving control over development, like giving the final go-ahead from the city council to the planning commission. And like that's a pretty substantive change, particularly because Delaware is the fastest growing county in the state. The city is seeing mass expansion. And so yeah, just like casual, like there's been a lot of brouhaha about developments near us and taking farmland and woods. And
Yeah.
so like just at the bus stop, I'm like, hey, did you know they want to move control over those decisions to block
Yeah.
to because we have a development going up right next to us, and it was a whole thing. So it's a really easy in to be like, actually, like the changes to the charter are super important.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, just finding those ways to like weave it in because you know the people that are in your life. And for some people, that's going to be an issue that resonates because you're at the bus stop. And for other people, it's something else.
That was Jen Perez, the Ohio Program Director for Red, Wine, and Blue. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Coming up, how Gen Z is going to impact this election. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day,
we are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Stever. With 2 weeks left until Election Day, the name of the game is persuasion. Not necessarily persuading people to vote for your cause or candidate, but persuading them to vote at all. That's especially true for younger voters, whose turnout fluctuates more than other age groups. 41 million members of Gen Z are eligible to vote this election. 8 million of them have become eligible for the very first time. The generation has an opportunity to influence the outcome of elections across Ohio and the country, if they turn up. Jordan Schwartz is a research leader at the Harvard Public Opinion Project and co-chair of the Harvard Votes Challenge. He also calls Alliance Ohio home. Jordan, welcome to All Sides.
Hi, Anna. Thanks for having me.
So the first step to turning out voters of any age is to get them registered. So what kind of registration campaigns are you seeing on your college campus? Or are you hearing from friends at other schools?
Absolutely. So in terms of voter registration among college students, it is never an easy process, but it is definitely one that is happening on a larger scale than has ever happened before. If you look sort of across the history of the youth vote, there has been this huge push in the last 10 or so years to establish these institutionalized voter registration processes on college campuses. And I'm extremely proud to say that we've been leading the one here on Harvard's campus for the past year, trying to register as many people as possible, and then, of course, making sure that those registrations actually turn into voter turnout. And it differs a lot across different state lines, too. For example, in Ohio, you can register to vote online. That's not true in every state. But also, even for the next step, it's not always easy either. Because if you're requesting an absentee ballot, Sometimes you have to send in a physical form for a state like Ohio to actually request that ballot, and then it gets sent to you. You have to fill it out, and then you have to send it back, which is a really long and arduous process that most people don't expect to have to take to vote, for example, if they're living outside of their home state. But on the other side of things, you could have a state that has same-day voter registration, where perhaps you're voting where you're living or going to college. And in that case, it's a lot easier. So a lot of like what's currently going on with the voter registration apparatus on college campuses comes down to the location that they're in. But I can say with absolute confidence that there is a huge nationwide push to make this happen. The only question is, will it be successful this time around?
Yeah, I want to talk about a little bit of data on Ohio. So I looked at data from CIRCLE, which is Tufts University's Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement. So CIRCLE, it's just easier to say that than the mouthful. And what I found really sort of sad about Ohio is that registration rates for 18 to 29-year-olds are down 10% from where they were in 2020. And when it comes to those first-time voters, those 18 and 19-year-olds were down 28% from 2020. Now, there were some states that were up, like Michigan, and that may just be because they're a swing state and there's like serious get registered, get out the vote campaigns. But I talked with some folks here in Ohio about how they're getting the youth vote out, and I want to share some clips and get your take on that. So
For sure.
here's Cody Pettit. He's the chairman of the Ohio Young Republicans.
Well, I think you're seeing a little bit less of an investment from both sides of the aisle. So I think that's probably responsible for it. I was involved with the 2020 efforts as a volunteer in a lot of ways. And, you know, we were out there registering voters constantly. And I don't think there's as much of a push given Ohio has lost some of its competitiveness. So.
And here's Democratic State Rep Danny Isaacson, who's been going to different college campuses trying to get people to vote.
Fun going and talking to students. They want to be involved. They just don't always know how. And we've lost the culture of showing up on campuses and in schools and making our case to, you know, what could be a very large voting bloc that deserves to be engaged. But we do need some of this is infrastructure and laws too. We have to be creating environments where it's welcoming to vote, where they're encouraged to vote on campus. Ohio has embarrassingly low voter registration and voter turnout rates, particularly when it comes to young people. And that is a structural problem. Our young people are not any less informed or educated or passionate than young people in Wisconsin, Michigan, or Pennsylvania, but they don't have a government, and frankly, they don't have university administrations who are as committed to making sure that they get out and participate. And so we've got work to do to improve the civic health of the state for young people.
So, I mean, it sounds similar to some of the things that you were saying, and it's three different interpretations. We're not a swing state, so there's less national infrastructure. It is tricky to vote on a college campus here in Ohio, and it's just if it's not easy and it's not simple, like what you were talking about, it's sometimes just it doesn't happen.
Yeah. I mean, definitely all three of those play a role. Certainly, there's been a huge shift in the past decade or so from the partisan voter registration and turnout model that has historically been the case for young people, where, you know, a Democratic and a Republican campaign will go to college campuses and say, this is why you should vote for us. And also, you should register to vote and turn out soon. And now you really don't see as much of that, which is what we just heard. And instead, you have this very nonpartisan system that aims to get out the vote no matter who you're voting for, which has been quite successful nationwide in getting out the vote. Both 2018 and 2020 had record rates of youth voter turnout, especially among college students. And even 2022, while a major drawback from 2018, was still higher than it's been for most of the past midterms in the past 40 years. That being said, in a state like Ohio, where there isn't the infrastructure, where there isn't quite the same partisan commitment, we're definitely not getting the same level of voter registration. And I think that's pretty apparent from the CIRCLE data you were talking about earlier.
Yeah, Michigan and Nevada, two of the top registration places for young voters, have recently implemented automatic voter registration. You know, Michigan and Pennsylvania also have same-day voter registration. Do you think these kinds of changes make it more likely to see young voters?
As someone who works in the voter registration space on my college campus, 100%. I cannot count the number of times that I've talked to people and they really want to vote. They want to make their voice heard, but they just can't because they've missed their state's voter registration deadline. In Ohio, it was weeks ago already, a month before the election, making it really difficult unless you're super tapped in, super engaged to register, you know, on campus or even within the state at large. prior to the election unless you really have a plan. And that's what a lot of the work that we do goes into, making that plan to vote as early as possible. But when students are dealing with, you know, midterm exams and their homework and all of these essays, can you really expect them to have a plan to vote and register over a month before they're even thinking about all these things? That's really difficult.
In a state they may not be living in.
Exactly, yeah.
I should point out that Ohio State University is going fully remote on Election Day, and many of the professors are not holding class to allow both faculty and students to vote. So they are at least making an effort for those who want to go vote on Election Day. But nationally, youth turnout in the 2022 election was 23%, so not bad for a midterm election, but it was 37% in Michigan, 32% in Pennsylvania, and 21% here in Ohio. And I wonder if this is a reflection about how people feel about their vote counting or making a difference. That if you live in one of these super close swing states, you think, my gosh, every vote counts. If you live in Ohio where Trump is expected to win by 4, 8, 12 points, you think maybe it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely a point to that, especially when we had competitive races in Michigan and states like Nevada, Arizona. And I mean, young voters turned out, voters on the whole turned out in ways they didn't. But we also had a relatively competitive Senate race in Ohio, or at least one that could have been had we had the same sort of youth turnout that we had in Michigan or Nevada or Arizona. And so a lot of it, again, comes down to communicating to young people way ahead of the election that their voice can be heard, that their votes can count, and they can make a difference, but only if they vote in huge numbers. And, you know, we've seen the results on both sides for what that actually looks like.
Yeah, there's a number of races here that are going to be incredibly close. Sherrod Brown versus Moreno, Marcy Kaptur versus Derek Marin, Amelia Sykes, Greg Landsman. There's a number of races where every single vote is going to count.
Absolutely. I mean, Ohio might not be a swing state in the presidential election anymore, but it certainly is, especially for congressional races and the Senate.
Let's talk about what motivates Gen Z to the polls in terms of issues. So I want to circle back to Representative Isaacson again, who said it's not so different from what motivates anyone to vote.
Here's what I tell people,
yes,
young or not. The most convincing thing you can say to someone else is why you care about it, why it matters to you, why this election is important to you. If that's because you're worried about housing costs, if it's because of you want a candidate who understands the need for new child care policies, if it's because of higher education investment or climate change or gun safety, whatever your issue is, that is going to come across as the most authentic and the most compelling. And so I was registering students last year for the reproductive rights effort, and I'll never forget it because it was the power of persuasion. There's a group of five students on the University of Cincinnati's campus, one woman, four young men, and they kind of blew me off, led by the man, when I asked if he wanted to register to vote. And then the young woman stopped her friends. She said, this election, because of this issue, I feel is existential for me. And so if you're my friend, you're going to register to vote and you're going to make sure to participate in this election. And sure enough, two of the young men who were not registered got registered right then and there.
Do you find that to be true? If you're talking to a group of people on campus, if one of them speaks up and says, actually, this is really important to my life, that it has that effect?
100%. And we know from so much research that's out there in the voter registration space that by far the most effective way to talk to people is something called relational organizing, where it's, you know, not some random number coming from one of us, but instead one of their closest friends being like, hey, have you registered to vote? And how can we help? And when it comes to the issues that motivate young voters, I think there's this perception that it's these, you know, really out there ones that have very little to do with a lot of the issues that have historically driven politics in the U.S. But that's really not the case. And especially now we know that it's basic cost of living concerns more than anything else that motivate young people. For the Harvard Youth Poll this past spring, we did an analysis of 16 major issues, everything from inflation and gun violence and jobs and corruption to women's reproductive rights and climate change and taxes in Israel-Palestine. And what we found was, by and large, inflation dominated as the most important issue, followed by healthcare, housing, gun violence, and jobs, with one key caveat. Among young Democrats and young women in particular, women's reproductive rights was extremely important and won out even against inflation on average. So it's those issues that drive people. This unique case of women's reproductive rights post-Dobbs, combined with really deep concerns about cost of living and being able to live in modern America.
I want to tease out that fear about financial future, because I also looked at some of the Harvard Youth Poll data, and it showed a 14-point shift from Democrats to Republicans since 2020, particularly when it comes to young men. And that's something I heard from Cody Pettit here in Ohio.
Overall, it's just trying to meet young voters where they are. And I think you're seeing a shift from years past. You know, generally younger voters are not necessarily Republicans in general, but I think you are starting to see some of that chip away, as we've seen with this economy currently, where younger voters especially are feeling a lot of the brunt from inflation, a lot of the struggles with, you know, getting affordable housing. So
what do you make of the push, both explicitly by the Trump campaign and in some of the polling data, that young male voters are moving more Republican?
I think it's pretty clear that they are definitely moving right from where they were in 2020. It's less clear as to whether they'll still support Democrats on net or whether they'll support Republicans. So in our last poll, our first fall poll, stay tuned for our next one coming out in a few days. But in our first one of this fall, we saw that Democrats were still winning likely voter young men by a fairly significant margin, around 17 points. But that was 30 points lower than the margin by which Democrats were winning young women, which is by far the biggest gender gap we've ever seen in our poll. And now if you look at other polls, sometimes they'll even have like that young men demographic, even going to Republicans, maybe not sorted by likely voters, but that's like a whole thing to dive into. And so the question is, A, like, why is this happening? A key part of it, of course, being the issue of reproductive rights and how that has kept women's numbers high for Democrats. Well, of course, hasn't done the same thing for young men. And then this issue of young men oftentimes feeling that the Democratic Party has abandoned them and isn't necessarily looking out for their perspectives. And there's a really great op-ed by our director of polling, John Della Volpe, in the New York Times yesterday. I encourage everyone to read it.
I read it. It's fantastic.
But, thank you. I can't claim credit. It's all him. But it really looks at this idea that young men, by and large, are not that different from young women. When we look at their basic ideological ideas, you know, support for government, healthcare, support for like basic human rights and all of these things, they're really not that different. And they have these values that are still relatively progressive. But they do differ in terms of party identification and who they plan to vote for. And a lot of that really does come down to the messaging that has happened. So from the perspective of the Trump campaign, honestly, they're doing a really smart campaign of trying to reach out to young men. And it's hard to say whether it's succeeding and to what degree, but it sure does seem like they are making a dent in the numbers that eventually made Biden win in 2020 and that Kamala Harris will need if she wants to win this time around as well.
I just want to ask about the war in Gaza, because we saw a lot of campus protests over the last year. And what you hear, particularly from more progressive voters, is it's a decision they're not considering Trump. They're just trying to decide whether to vote at all.
Yeah. I mean, young people have definitely been struggling with that. We know that it's not the vast majority of young people who see it as the single issue they're voting on, but it is definitely a concern for a lot of people. In our spring poll, we did a deeper dive into the issue, and we found that there's 5-to-1 support for a ceasefire. I believe it was 51% to 10%. At the same time, 3 in 5 young people were not closely following news about the war. So it's not the number one issue for the majority of young people. But then again, if there's a significant portion of young people that look at it and see this is an issue where, you know, I can't feel morally that I'm going to vote for Kamala Harris because of this, that could seriously impact her margin. And I think that is a part of why we're not necessarily seeing the same sort of high turnout in our poll that we would have seen 4 years ago, despite Kamala Harris keeping her margin high among Democrats. But specifically with regards to this issue, we also know that young people overwhelmingly support the actual human beings involved in this conflict. We asked questions about empathy for the people of Israel and the people of Palestine. And by and large, young people on both sides of the aisle sympathized with both, but had less popular opinions of both the Israeli and Palestinian governments. And so, again, young people do support the people involved, and they want to see change. The just question is, for any politician right now, how can you do that without alienating the older base that is so deeply pro-Israel?
We got a message from Francis in Columbus that I love this idea. I want to share it with you. She suggests that the Big Ten schools here have a competition to see who can register the most voters to encourage turnout. And yeah, if you made it a fight between Ohio and Michigan, oh my goodness, you could probably convince people to turn out.
See, it's funny you actually mentioned this because there is just that sort of program that is currently underway. I've worked over the summer at a group called the All-In Campus Democracy Challenge that helps organize voting groups across the country at a variety of universities. And as it so happens, there are these things called athletic conference challenges, where schools within the conference try and register as many people as they can, try and have the highest voter turnout. And once those numbers come back, a year or 2 years after the election, there are awards for which campus does the best. And so, yes, it is in development, it is being advertised. And as an Ohioan, I deeply hope that Ohio State can win.
Are you voting in Ohio this year, or are you voting in Massachusetts?
I am. I just cast my absentee ballot a couple days ago, and I'm super excited to have voted.
That was Jordan Schwartz, a research team leader for Harvard's Public Opinion Project. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Anna.
Coming up, how labor unions are mobilizing and perhaps shifting their political allegiances. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Democrats have relied on the support of unions for decades. That is, until Donald Trump came along. Sean O'Brien, the head of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, actually addressed the Republican National Convention this summer, a first in the organization's 121-year history. O'Brien's union endorsed Biden in 2020, but this year, the Teamsters are sitting out, choosing not to endorse either candidate. Joining us now is Robert Forant to unpack what this means and the history of union support. He's a professor of U.S. history and labor studies at UMass Lowell. Professor Forant, welcome to All Sides.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
So, like I said in the opening there, the Teamsters are not endorsing a candidate in this presidential election. How big of a decision is that?
It could matter in the areas of the country where the vote is probably going to be quite close, like particularly around the Great Lakes, states that the Democrats really need to win.
The blue wall.
That, pardon me?
What we call the blue wall, right?
The blue wall, yeah. I mean, definitely we can throw Pennsylvania in there, but Wisconsin, Minnesota, Michigan, for sure. And the labor vote's going to be critically important there. So conceivably, it would matter. I think that historically, workers in unions tended to vote the way their leadership sort of leaned or endorsed. But I think that over the last, probably since Ronald Reagan, the labor vote has become much less predictable than historically it was. It's also the case that the labor vote, if you think of the labor vote as a union vote, it's not actually as great as it was, say, back in the 60s, early 70s, because union membership has so dramatically declined over the last couple of decades.
You also see Trump and his running mate, J.D. Vance, making an explicit play for that populist sort of union movement. We saw Vance out at some of the picket lines that Sherrod Brown was out at in Ohio. It's interesting to watch this sort of almost progressive populism pick up in the RNC platform.
Yeah, I think that they, the same way that the Democrats realize how important the blue wall, as you put it, those states are, Republicans have realized that as well. And I think that what they've been trying to do is fracture what labor historians traditionally would have sort of called the New Deal coalition, sort of something dating back to the 1930s where big labor unions were organized. There's sort of like that labor vote, African American vote, and those were traditionally seen as always going to the Democratic camp. But again, that's really changed a lot over the last 25 to 30 years. And so I think it's right. I mean, on the other hand, Donald Trump appeared with Elon Musk and a few weeks ago, and in that conversation, Donald Trump appeared to say to Elon Musk, if your workers in your auto factories are thinking of striking, fire them, which is anathema to labor people. So, and Donald Trump in the White House was very much trying to hone in on and disrupt, if not eliminate, unions in the federal government. So these things are leaving a bad taste in labor's mouth. But again, I'm not sure how much the average working person knows that that's what was happening in Washington, D.C. So it's unclear to me what it'll actually translate to at the ballot box.
Yeah, when you look at, so here in Northeast Ohio, you look at the Youngstown area, what we would probably call the Rust Belt part of our state, mm-hmm. used to be reliably blue. It has gone red for Trump in 16 and 2020. And it's been interesting to watch that shift at the same time that the suburbs, so the college-educated suburban voters, have gone red to blue. It's sort of a realignment structurally of the two parties.
Yeah, very much so. It's actually like what I'm going to be talking about in my class this afternoon. I was scribbling notes while I was waiting to come on, sort of comparing Democrats and Republicans in 1960 and Democrats and Republicans in 2024. And so you're right, that's definitely something that's flipped over time, I think. And it really starts back, to sort of date myself, by Richard Nixon in the 1968 and then the 1972 campaigns, very explicitly appealed to workers. And he referred to particularly white workers as the, you know, sort of like the forgotten man, and that I'm going to speak up for you. And in a way, Donald Trump has sort of taken that kind of a Nixon playbook. And particularly, like you say, in Northwest Ohio, I live in Lowell, and Lowell has seen the hollowing out of its textile industry post-World War II. And so you have a lot of angst amongst the workers that have been disrupted, had their lives really reshaped by the loss of work. And typically, I think, blame politicians in general for that happening, when the structural questions are a lot bigger. But I definitely think Republicans have done a better job of blaming the Democrats for these things, when I don't think it's really, again, looking at the history, that both parties have presided over this sort of dismantling of American manufacturing, Youngstown sheet and tube, the rubber industry in Ohio, steel industry. And that animosity is still there. I mean, I actually was a machinist before becoming an academic, and the place I worked in closed in the 1980s, and I went back to school. And I'm still upset from the 1980s with the people that made the decisions to close the place I worked in. So that doesn't go away.
I will say, though, President Biden made history as the first U.S. president to visit a picket line to striking auto workers. He refused to step in to stop the dock worker strike. Registration for unions has been up under his administration. Like, arguably, he has been a good friend of labor.
Yeah, I mean, I think that he has sort of claimed the mantle of being the most pro-labor president since Franklin Roosevelt. And I think based on what you've been describing, and I think the way I look at the history, that's probably a fairly accurate summary. What's interesting is a lot of the labor organizing that's happened has been in the public sector, like teachers, also a lot in healthcare, and people desperately trying to organize Amazon warehouses. And in Massachusetts, there's a lot of discussion about Uber drivers and DoorDash and things like that. And so it's a whole... In some ways, it's like a third wave of labor, where you had the crafts and the trades in the late 19th, early 20th century, mass production in the mid 30s, and now sort of high tech computer based occupations are being organized now. And at least right now, they identify more closely with the Democrats. There's also a really big hotel strike scattered around the country. Boston, that strike has picked up again, and I think that disruption, if you will, is really supporting Democratic candidates more often than Republican.
I wonder if you've looked at how that support, if you believe Biden is the union guy, does that translate to Kamala Harris? Because it seems like she doesn't pay, she is saying, I am not Biden. And in some ways, that's really helpful on the economy and inflation and gas prices. But it doesn't seem to be helpful when it comes to union support to be like, I'm not that guy.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a legacy in the labor movement of it's a guy thing. And even though some of the more powerful unions, particularly like flight attendants and in healthcare and in teaching, the unions that are growing in the country, a lot of them are headed up by women. I still think there's still that level of misogyny, I guess you could say, within the labor movement. And when I think the stereotype is when labor people get together, it's a bunch of guys with cigars and whiskey, right? And sort of that's still a throwback to the late 19th, early 20th century. So, right, I think that like Biden walking that picket line, as you mentioned, in the auto workers was a big deal. I think in the next 2 weeks, it would serve her well in terms of her candidacy to try to find some symbolic similar thing that she could do to say I'm on your side, because right now it looks as though, I mean, I saw polls this morning in Pennsylvania that there's a slight lead for Donald Trump. I've told my students if Pennsylvania goes Republican, I'm going to bed, because it's over. So it'll definitely, the labor vote's going to really be a huge vote at the end of the day.
Yeah, that brings me to my next question, which is polling shows increasingly a split amongst union members, not union leadership, but the rank and file members are increasingly divided over who they're going to vote for.
Yeah, and again, I think it boils down to, it's not like my dad was a union person, and he took me with him when he voted for John F. Kennedy back in 1960. And when we were driving home, he told me if I ever voted Republican, he would come back from the grave and haunt me. That like depth of connection isn't that doesn't translate, I don't think, anymore in the same way that it did, to my dad's generation. People who got decent wages and benefits in a union contract coming out of World War II, that doesn't play the same way now that it did for my dad. I don't imagine I would tell my son I would come back to haunt him. I would tell him I wouldn't like him, but I wouldn't come back to haunt him.
Yeah, coming back from the grave is that's an intense level of feeling about how
Yeah,
you're.
I mean, when I was driving home, I was thinking, okay, this is a lesson I don't forget.
Yeah, I also think the fight for an 8-hour workday, for child labor laws, for the FDA, for all of that. We're talking 100 years ago when labor bosses were beaten and they were shot, and like the danger of organizing wasn't getting fired, it was losing your life.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, when I teach labor history, I usually start the first class with a list of just the things you just mentioned, and where do you think they came from, and how do you think we have them, and how long do you think it was that people fought for the 8-hour day or a minimum wage or Social Security or, things like that. And for the most part, they don't know. And this is the case even, like, I would say probably half of my students every semester are from a union household. But they don't know that either. And whoever the person, mom or dad, is in a union, they haven't talked to their kids either about that. So I say, well, go home and talk to them about where these things came from. And they sort of look at me like, talk to my parents about stuff. But they don't know, right? So again, that legacy isn't rooted. It's not, again, it's something I talked about in my household with my mom and my dad around the kitchen table. It was known where the money came from, and that the union was in his estimation responsible for it. I don't feel like that happens with any great degree of regularity anymore.
Yeah, it didn't happen with me, but I took AP history classes that required me to read both The Jungle and Ayn Rand. So we got like the full perspective.
There's an extreme.
Yeah, but you got two totally different versions of the same period in history.
Brilliant. No, I think that's really, I mean, I would love to be able to. If I assign my class Atlas Shrugged or Fountainhead from Ayn Rand, that wouldn't work. They would look at how thick they were.
I love a good book that big.
No, me too.
That big. Obviously. I mean, it's like 800 pages, but still, it's not. Yeah. I read fantasy, so that's like not a lot.
Yeah, yeah. That's small, right? Yeah.
That was Robert Forant, professor of U.S. History and Labor Studies at UMass Lowell. Thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you all for listening to All Sides, right here on 89.7 NPR News.